Welcome to another episode of 40 Minutes in the Old Testament. 40 Minutes in the Old Testament is a 1517 Podcast Network podcast. You can go to 1517.org/podcast. Check out all the other podcasts that are living over there. And check out all the other things that are living over there. All the articles, Crafted Preaching. You can check out the videos that are over there. You can go to YouTube, check out all the videos that are going on over there as well. Always new series. Chad releases a video every week. We've got new series dropping all the time. So check out that stuff. Subscribe, ring the bell. Chad, we're still in the Book of Ruth. Things got a little weird last episode. We did some translation work. Ruth made a bold move, and we're waiting to see what Boaz is going to do, how he's going to respond.
Yeah, the moment of truth has arrived. Yeah, I mean, there's lots of different directions this could have gone. Some good and some not good and some really bad. So, I mean, that's what made it a bold and risky move on the part of Ruth and Naomi to decide that, yeah, this is the way we're going to kind of force Boaz to make a decision.
Yeah, well, yeah, it's interesting because the harvest is over. They just had a big old party because they had a famine. So then now you have they had this great harvest. They bust out the wine. Everyone's feeling good. But what this also means is that gleaning in those fields is over. So yes. So this sort of redeemer light thing that's going on where Ruth and Naomi have this, not just food, but sort of a little means of income or whatever else they're doing with all this grain that they're getting. Well, that's going to be coming to a close. And so it makes sense that Naomi's like, well, now is time to make a different move. Now you could try to come up with some other plan, but Naomi seems to be reading the tea leaves a little bit here, and she thinks that this guy is a little bit interested in Ruth, but he might not be a make a first move kind of guy. And so She tells Ruth, it's now or never.
Yeah, I think that's kind of what's going on. And I pick up on some of that from the way that he does respond. That, yeah, yep. I think undoubtedly he was interested in her, but he probably was thinking, she's not interested in me. You know, I'm too old for her or whatever it might be. I think it was all one-sided. Like he thought that, yes, he was interested in her, but he thought she probably would be looking elsewhere. And so, that just was his personality. You know, some guys just, you gotta push them in that direction. You know, girls have to kind of make the first move in that way.
And maybe this is different if she's an Israelite. I mean, there's obviously a component here where maybe he's interested, but he's got, he's got a little bit of cold feet, not just because they were uncovered, but just like he's a guy with cold feet in general. And because he's like, yeah, I'm interested in that woman, but I mean, she's a Moabite. And, you know, as we said before, she might have still had all her widow stuff on. And so maybe too soon to make a move. Should I make a move at all? What are other people going to think? It's not exactly what people would expect me to do.
Yeah,
I mean, we've seen all this stuff play out before. What is mom going to think?
You know? Yeah, exactly. Exactly. Yeah.
So Ruth, it was going to take Ruth being aggressive and maybe like making him an offer he can't refuse.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, and that's where we are. He's got to make a decision now. It's not like he can stall anymore because we're on the threshing floor. It's the middle of the night. She's uncovered his quote-unquote feet, which we talked about last time, probably like making him partially naked. And then she basically pops the question when he asks, who are you? You know, it's dark. He can't quite see who she is. She says, I'm Ruth, your maid. So spread your wings and spread your covering over your maid, for you are a redeemer. So there's no putting off a decision. The moment of truth has arrived. Let me mention this before we move on, because I talked about it in the last episode. I mentioned that the first time that Ruth has a conversation with Boaz, she identifies herself as the lowest rank of servant. Now this time she identifies herself as a little bit higher rank of servant. So this time she is an ama, which my translation has maid, so maid servant to maid. It's kind of, we don't really have English words that help us out here, but the first time she's the lowest servant. Now she's an ama, which is a little bit higher servant. And she's basically saying at this point, now raise me up to the level of wife. Marry me. Spread your covering over me because you are a Goel. You are a redeemer. All right, moment of truth, verse 10. What's he going to say? Boaz responded, "May you be blessed of the Lord, my daughter. You have shown your last kindness to be better than the first by not going after young men, whether poor or rich. And now, my daughter, do not fear. I will do for you whatever you ask. For all my people in the city know that you are a woman of excellence. And now, it is true, I am a redeemer. However, there is a redeemer closer than I." So that must have been like, you know, different levels of closeness to the family to determine who actually was supposed to take the action first. So it wasn't like you had just one redeemer per family. "So there is a redeemer closer than I. Remain this night." So he wants her to stay there with him. "And when morning comes, if he, that other guy, if he will redeem you, good, let him redeem you. But if he doesn't want to redeem you, then I will redeem you as the Lord lives." So he swears an oath. And then he says to Shakab to lie down until morning. I'll go ahead and finish out the chapter. So she lay at his feet. Same word again in Hebrew, as we saw earlier. She lay at his feet until morning and rose before anybody could recognize her. And then I guess he kind of communicates to the rest of the people who were out there to be hush-hush about it. He says, "Let it not be known that the woman came to the threshing floor." So he wasn't out there by himself, in other words. Probably, you know, the people who were helping him thresh, they were out there. They had a party. People laying around. Maybe somebody saw her, and he's like, "Don't tell anybody. Let's keep this quiet." Verse 15, so before he sends her away, he says, "Give me the cloak that it's on you and hold it." So she holds it out, and he measures out 6 measures of barley, however much that was, we're not really told, 6 measures of barley. And he laid it on her, and then she went into the city. And when she came to her mother-in-law, who This is not in the Hebrew, of course, but you kind of suspect Naomi was up all night, right? She came to her mother-in-law, who had been up all night wondering what had happened. And she says, "How did it go?" You know, of course, that's the first thing she's going to ask. "How did it go, my daughter?" And she told her all that the man had done for her. And then she says, "These 6 measures of barley he gave me, for he said, don't go to your mother-in-law empty-handed." Which I think is super cool, because that word that's used for empty-handed is the same word that is used by Naomi herself. Remember when she got back to Bethlehem initially, and she said to all the women of the city, you know, "Don't call me Naomi, call me Mara. I'm bitter now." And she says, "I went out full, but I came back empty." So it's pretty cool that at this point, Boaz isn't just concerned about Ruth. He's actually concerned about Naomi as well. He didn't want Ruth to return from this night liaison empty-handed.
Doesn't it seem like grain. When he sends her back with something to show Naomi, this seems like a wink to let Naomi know, like, pretty interested.
Yeah. Yeah, very interested. One commentator I was reading on this, I found this pretty convincing, that metaphorically, this is basically him promising, especially given the whole context here. It's like she's holding out in front of her this cloak, and he's filling it with seed to take back home, as if he wants to metaphorically promise that, yeah, I'm going to do my duty as a redeemer, and I've just given her all of this seed, and yeah, part of my duty as a redeemer is going to be make sure that some seed, some offspring come forth from her as well. I don't think that's too much of a stretch, given everything that's been happening through the night. So she relays this, and then the chapter ends with Naomi saying to her, "Wait, my daughter, until you know how the matter turns out. For the man will not rest until he has settled it today." Yeah. So now we know what happened. Now we know Boaz's response.
Yeah, and this response, what Naomi says to her, makes it seem like there this is hard to know. We just don't have enough information. At least I don't have enough information. Maybe you do, Chad. There's this other guy. There's apparently an order that you need to follow, mm-hmm. and this sort of thing. So Boaz, being the, you know, the by the book kind of dude that he is, I guess, is going to try to do the right thing here. He says, well, technically, I don't read this as Boaz saying, I'd rather not. I'm going to try to pass you off on this other guy. If he just won't, I guess I will.
Yeah.
It seems more like he is very much like, I would, but we have to eliminate this guy, this first. Yeah. And so I doubt that Boaz is going to go and push too hard for this guy to do it.
Yeah. It's, in fact, we'll get to that in the next chapter, but you can, and we'll be able to, I'll bring this out once we get to that part, but you can tell just from the Hebrew itself, the way it's phrased, and just the whole way that Boaz goes about presenting the situation, that he wants this guy to say no.
It's
sort of a setup on Boaz's part. So you got to give the guy some rhetorical credit for the way that he handles the whole situation. Yeah. Once we get to chapter four.
But yeah, so this does not seem like something that Boaz necessarily wants to do, but more something that he feels he has to do.
Yeah, because, you know, there could be repercussions. You know, if he went ahead and said, yeah, let's do it. You know, I'll be your redeemer. And this other guy actually was interested in doing this, redeeming not only Ruth, but also the land that belonged to Naomi. And, you know, so if he was interested in that and Boaz kind of, you know, cut in front of him, that could have led to some problems, you know, a little bit of instability there in their small village of Bethlehem. So Boaz is going to do the right thing. He's going to make sure that he follows the order that he's supposed to. To get to your statement, we don't really know enough about the way this worked to say a whole lot, but evidently there were, you know, gradations of redeemerhood, if you will. You know, like we'll say, you know, something happens to your brother and you would be first in line to act as a redeemer, right? But what if something happened to you? Well, maybe your cousin would be next. Mm-hmm. And if it wasn't your cousin, maybe, you know, your second. Anyway, I'm sure it was like family relations. The closest family relation was the one who had the first duty, responsibility, opportunity to engage in the act of redemption.
Yeah. And we don't know how far Boaz is removed. We know he's a relative. That could be third cousin. Who knows what that is? I would say that it's really good reason. It's not a brother. It never refers to him as the brother of Naomi or the brother of Naomi's husband or anything like that. So he probably is further removed.
Right. Yeah. Yeah. So we don't know exactly how closely familial connected he is, but anyway, close enough to where he's in that line of redemption. You know, when he responds to her, it's obvious, of course, right away that he's happy about this. You know, he blesses her and he says, you've shown kindness to me. You're gracious to me because you haven't gone after young men, whether old or rich, which this is the first, if memory serves me, this is the first time that we have any indication that Boaz is a little bit older guy,
mm-hmm.
you know, and I'm not saying he's like 50 or 60. He's just, you know, probably older than most of the guys that he considered would be her suitors. So he was probably expecting her to go after one of them or expecting them to go after her, but that hadn't happened. So she was interested in only him. And he says, of course, after that everybody in the city has got you figured out. Everybody knows that you are you're a woman of excellence. So that verb that's used, that the word that's used there, chayil, is the same word, interestingly, that's used to describe Boaz himself. He's a man of excellence. So it's probably, you know, word has spread and everybody, like we discussed last time, it's a small place. Everybody's going to know who Ruth is and be like, man, she, look at that. Look at all she's done for her family. Look at all that she's done for Naomi. She's a woman of chayil. She's a woman of excellence. Everybody knows this.
Yeah, you would think this would be this statement that he makes is in direct relation to the fact that she did not leave Naomi. Not only did she not leave her, but now she's out in the field every day, like gleaning mm-hmm. and bringing this bad light. They're like, man, this daughter-in-law that Naomi's got is something else.
Yeah. I mean, there's never any indication that Naomi's out there with her.
No.
You know, and maybe she was
older.
Elderly. We really know how old she was, but maybe she just wasn't able to, or maybe she really didn't need to. I mean, if Ruth is bringing back even a fraction of what she brought back that first time, well, they're set. You know, they're good. They could open a bread store with all of the grain. Yeah,
maybe Naomi knows. Back. Naomi probably knows. Like, look, man, ain't no one dropping off extra grain for me.
Yeah, Ruth, on the other hand, yeah, they're dropping handfuls for her. So anyway, they come up with a plan. He wants her to stay there the rest of the night, and then when morning comes, he's gonna send her back, and he then will go about the business of making sure that he takes care of everything that needs to be taken care of officially to get them redeemed. I don't think if there's anything else I need to add about chapter 3. You want to throw out anything else?
No, I think we're ready to do it.
All right, well, let's keep on with chapter 4 then. So what's going to happen next? Well, now we're going to have a legal proceeding and have a little bit of a surprise thrown in here. Only a surprise in this sense. So far, we've heard plenty of talk about redemption and Boaz being a Goel, being one of these redeemers. But there really hasn't been anything mentioned about land. Everything has been kind of connected with, or at least hinted at, with regard to Boaz acting as a redeemer toward Ruth. But we're going to encounter now in chapter 4 kind of a surprise, because it wasn't just Ruth that was part of this responsibility of redemption, but also Lan was involved as well. So what happens? Well, the chapter starts out with Boaz going up to the gate, and he sits down, and it says, behold, so that's that hine, Hebrew word that catches our attention, which some translations leave out, but I think it's good. Anytime you see a behold, it's wanting to capture your attention, like, hey, look, one of those kind of situations. So, hey, look, this redeemer that Boaz had spoken about last night was passing by. So Boaz says to him, well, this is my translation. Turn aside, friend, sit down here. And he turned aside and sat down. There's a Hebrew phrase that's used there that happens to be one of my favorite Hebrew phrases, only because it sounds really cool. So in English, if we don't know somebody's name, or you know, we've forgotten their name, or maybe we're trying to kind of keep it a little bit, what's the word I'm looking for? Anonymous. We might say something like Mr. So-and-so, right? Or hey, you, if we don't know the person.
This happens to me all the time when someone comes up to me that I know but yeah, I don't remember their name. I'm sure this has happened to you, Chad.
Oh, yeah.
Someone comes up to you and they're like, hey, Dan, what's up, man? And I'm like, what's up, bro? And I'm sitting there racking my brain, like, what is this dude's name?
Oh yeah, yeah, that's happened to me. That's happened to me plenty of times. So for whatever reason, this guy's name is not included here, which is kind of unusual, because I mean, this book is full of names, right? We know everybody's name.
Yeah,
but this guy's name is left out. Some people speculate it's because, you know, yeah, because of what happens, and they're sort of trying to protect his reputation, because he didn't do what really he was by duty bound to do. But for whatever reason, so here's the phrase: when you don't know, or when you're trying to hide somebody's name in Hebrew, you refer to them as Poloni Almoni, which I just love the way that sounds. It's just one of those phrases that I love the way it sounds. So Poloni Almoni
sounds like a pasta dish.
Yeah, it does sound like something you'd order at an Italian restaurant. I'll have the Poloni Almoni. But I've read several articles about this particular phrase, so they've tried to figure out exactly what it means, but that is by far the consensus. Is it just is a phrase that means Mr. So-and-so in Hebrew, or hey, you. So he sees this guy and he's like, hey, Poloni Almoni, come over here and sit down. So the guy does. So they're at the gate of the city, which we have discussed in the past. The gate is where a lot of business happens. It's also where any kind of legal proceedings happen. So he chooses the gate. He finds the guy, and he chooses, verse 2, 10 men of the elders of the city and says, sit down here. So they sat down. So 10 is a typical number that you need for some kind of legal decision to be made, some kind of official. It's like a quorum, basically. You need at least 10 guys for there to be some kind of official decision, or at least for them to serve as witnesses as two men work out an agreement between themselves. So he gets Poloni Almoni, and he gets the 10 guys, and they all sit down together. And I guarantee you that Boaz has been practicing this speech. He's like, what am I going to say? Let's see. Because, it's a little bit delicate situation because, everything happened last night, and I really want to redeem Ruth. But, I got this other guy. So how am I going to make this as unattractive as possible to this guy so that he doesn't want to do this? So here's the speech. I'll just read it. This is verse 3 and following. Naomi, who has come back from the land of Moab, has to sell the piece of land which belonged to our brother Elimelech. By the way, our brother doesn't mean they were like brothers. That's typical Hebrew way of referring to someone who's a close relative.
Yeah, so the ESV just says to our relative. Yeah.
Oh, yeah. Good, good. Yeah. So it's to our relative Elimelech. So it starts out, okay, we are just more or less stating something that everybody knows. Naomi's back from Moab, and now we have this piece of land. And it's a little bit difficult to understand. I've looked at several different sources on this, exactly what is happening here. Because here's the problem. In Hebrew law, this might sound strange to us, but this is the way it was set up. In Hebrew law, land, so if I die, my land does not automatically go to my wife, to my widow. It went to my children, all right? But here's the problem is that her sons are both deceased. So the land is just kind of in this legal limbo, if you will. So is she selling it outright? Or as some have argued, is she going to do something where it's kind of like, now I'm forgetting the legal term. Is it usufruct? You familiar with that? I believe that's a phrase. Some have argued that what she's basically saying, or what he's basically saying is, listen, we have this land and she is going to let somebody use it as long as they don't abuse it.
It's like a lease, right?
Yeah, it's kind of like a lease. Yeah. So she can't legally sell the property. But she's got this property, and we need to make a decision as to who's going to use it, who is going to own it. And anyway, that's he's presented the situation. So he goes on, verse 4. So I thought to inform you, literally uncover your ear, one of those Hebrew idioms. I'm going to let you know, right? I'm going to make sure you're aware of the situation. So I thought to inform you, saying, buy it before those who are sitting here and before the elders of my people. If you will redeem it, redeem it. But if not, tell me that I may know, for there is no one but you to redeem it, and I am after you. So he notice what he leaves out here. There is no mention whatsoever at this point about Ruth. It's all about the land, right? So here we got this land, and Naomi needs to do something with it, and you're first in line to act as a goel to redeem it. So, if you're going to do it, well, then do it. But if not, then I'll do it. So that's the way that Boaz is presenting this situation so far, anyway. And what does the guy say? End of verse 4, I will redeem it.
Yeah, he says, oh, okay, well.
Okay, yeah.
Let's do it.
That's good. All right. That's why I said Boaz set this whole thing up. But Boaz isn't done yet. So as soon as the guy says, I'll redeem it, Boaz says, oh, yeah, one more thing. On the day that you buy/acquire, kana in Hebrew, on the day that you kana the field from the hand of Naomi, you must also kana acquire Ruth, the Moabitess, the widow of the deceased, in order to raise up the name of the deceased on his inheritance. Now, this is even clearer in the Hebrew, the way this is set up, because the way I read it, it's like on the day that you get this field, you must also acquire Ruth the Moabitess. But in the Hebrew, Ruth the Moabitess, the widow of the deceased, all that's pushed to the front of the sentence. So it would be something like, on the day that you buy the field from the hand of Naomi, Ruth, that lady from Moab, who's a widow of the deceased guy, her you must also acquire. So just the way that he puts this all together, you can tell that he's really wanting to convince this guy not to do it.
And he's by acquire, I mean, he's not just saying, like, she'll be around.
Yeah.
Right. I mean, he's saying that you're going to have to perpetuate the name of the dead in his inheritance. So, like, I mean, you're about to have to go get married again.
Yes. Yeah. Or marry a second wife, which is also very possible.
Yeah.
Yeah. So I don't understand translators sometimes why they do this, but when it says, my translation, for instance, says you buy the field and you acquire Ruth, it's the exact same verb in both cases. It's kana. So either translate them both as buy or translate them both as acquire, but don't translate them with two different words when it's obvious from the very context that what is being communicated is, if you kana one, then you're also going to kana the other. One of my pet peeves about translations when they do that. I guess they didn't like the idea of him buying the wife. Well, okay. Well, then use acquire as it, because if you're not looking at it in English, you don't see that. So on the day that you get the field, you also get this wife. And so this is one of these kind of it's not a levirate marriage that we've talked about before, where like the brother of the deceased marries his brother's widow, but it is kind of like that too. It's kind of a mixture situation where you have one of those levirate marriages, but also this is an act of redemption.
And if this guy is already married, you can see why he might be hesitant. Like, oh, I don't know if my wife's going to love that.
Oh, yeah.
You can see why a dude might be like, oh, wait, what?
Yeah, yeah.
Because, I mean, he goes on to say, not to jump ahead, but look, I can't do this. I'm going to impair my own inheritance.
Yeah.
Right? I mean, this is the same as basically saying, like, man, I got a whole family thing going on here. I don't really feel like inserting anyone else into it.
Yeah. It's a lot to take on. I mean, you're taking on, he wanted the field because he thought, oh, that'd be great. You know, I got more crops, but he doesn't want the responsibility of a wife or a second wife. But also, if this is kind of a levirate marriage, what's going to happen? Well, if he does this and he has a son with Ruth, well, then that property that he just purchased is going to go to that son, to Ruth's son. That's the way the levirate marriage works. So he would end up, losing money in the bargain, basically. So after all this is said and done, then verse 6, he says, I can't do it. I can't redeem it for myself, lest I literally destroy. Yeah, jeopardize, but it's a pretty strong word that's used there in the Hebrew. To shahat is to wreck something. I'd wreck my own inheritance if I did that. So redeem it for yourself. You may have my right of redemption, for I cannot redeem it. And you can almost hear a sigh of relief from Boaz at this point. This is exactly how he wanted everything to go down.
Yeah, and maybe even this guy. So this is what makes, it's not explicit, but I think it's sort of implied in there that this guy is already married and probably already has children.
Probably so.
And Boaz does not, presumably. Mm-hmm. At least we haven't seen anything to suggest that he does. And right. So it would make sense this guy be like, oh, okay, if we're talking about that, no, like you, I got, dude, I already got the kids, the wife, like, this is going to complicate things. All you should do it. You should totally do it. Like, you're single. Yeah, this is all you, bro.
Yeah, exactly. So Poloni Amoni, Mr. So-and-so, he made the right choice. I mean, this is better for everybody in the long run.
And I guess, and Boaz then probably has to be like, well, I guess if I have to.
Yeah. Twist my arm. Now we have this kind of strange custom that's described next, where it says, in former times, this was the custom concerning the redemption exchange of land to confirm any matter, that a guy would take off his shoe, take his sandal off, and give it to another. This was the manner of attestation. So this redeemer said to Boaz, buy it for yourself, and he removed his sandal. And I guess that little exchange went down. Probably, we talked about this a long time ago, but probably judging from some customs we know from other cultures, Egyptian in particular, because the sandal was associated with walking on land, on soil, it kind of took on the symbolism of the soil, the land itself. So to claim property or to claim territory, you would often walk on that territory. You would put your foot down or put your sandal down on it. And so I think that's probably why this particular kind of custom originated. This is the only mention of it in the scriptures, though. So they do this. They do a little the sandal custom. And then Boaz says to the elders that they are witnesses that I have bought from the hand of Naomi all that belonged to Elimelech and all that belonged to Chilion and Mahlon, to the two sons. And not only that, but I've also acquired Ruth, the Moabitess, the widow of Mahlon, to be my wife in order to raise up the name of his deceased on his inheritance, so that the name of the deceased may not be cut off from his brothers or from the gate of his birthplace. You are witnesses today. So Boaz makes his speech basically saying, I'm going to be the one who steps up to the plate. I'm going to be the one who not only gets the land, but gets the widow, and I'm going to raise up children so that the name of the family of Naomi and Elimelech will be perpetuated. And everybody is happy about this. Verse 11 says, all the people who were in the court and in the gate and the elders, like, yep, we're witnesses. May the Lord make the woman who is coming into your home like Rachel and Leah, both of whom built the house of Israel. And may you achieve, well, my translation is achieve wealth in Ephrathah, but it can be translated a couple different ways, like achieve honor or something like that. And also that you may become renowned in Bethlehem. Moreover, may your house be like the house of Perez, whom Tamar bore to Judah, through the offspring which the Lord shall give you by this young woman.
Now that last,
so they know, that, their, that they know last, their Bible.
Yeah, that, well, that last part's interesting because they talk about Tamar and Judah, because obviously that was a little bit of a...
Yeah, that was a little bit unorthodox.
Yeah.
Just a little bit. Yeah.
Yeah. And so,
yeah, if you remember that story, it was she dressed up as a prostitute and seduced him. And yeah, well, she didn't have to do much seducing. She got pregnant.
Yeah.
And so that's the way. So we mention of her in this particular book is fascinating because, of course, Matthew mentions her and Ruth in his genealogy.
Yeah. Yeah. One, so. Yeah. So it's an interesting thing to bring up because, I mean, obviously Ruth is a Moabite. And so, yeah, you have this sort of nod to God being able to do some good things through some things that aren't typically the way things are done.
Yeah. Which is really it's sort of the message of this whole book, that God is able to take some pretty messed up situations and work in some pretty incredible ways that you'd never expect. I mean, I refer to this book very often when I'm talking about kind of is theology the cross approach, basically, where God is always working through what you would think would be the divine opposite, right? He's always surprising us by acting in very unexpected, seemingly undivine sorts of ways. I mean, Ruth is just a great book to illustrate that God was always interested in not just Israel. It wasn't like he had a thing for Israel and hated everybody else, which is sometimes the caricature that people give the Old Testament. He was always interested in all nations. He just chose Israel as his own treasured possession, and through her wanted to reach out to the rest of the nations. And of course, Ruth is one result of that.
Yeah, yeah. And one of the things that you sort of see a separation between these two redeemers, not that this other redeemer is a bad guy or anything, but you do see that he is interested in acquiring the land. That's fine with him.
Mm-hmm.
But acquiring this outsider, this Moabite widow. That's not something that he's interested in. When the exact opposite seems to be true for Boaz. I don't think Boaz, I don't think he cares about the land one bit.
No, I don't think he does. He probably has enough land already, you know? And you think about it, I mean, he's evidently a little bit older than most of the men, and presumably he had plenty of opportunities to marry.
Yeah.
But for whatever reason, he didn't. He didn't marry any of the girls of Bethlehem or any of the nearby villages. And then this Moabite woman comes along, he's like, yeah, I really like her.
Yeah. Well, and this is as Boaz, as redeemer, I mean, this is the kind of redeemer that you want. I mean, this is the kind of redeemer we get in Christ, that doesn't care about what we bring to the table whatsoever, is only interested in us.
Yeah.
He's only interested in redeeming us. We don't come and be like, well, you know, if you redeem me, you get this and you get this other thing. I mean, look at all the things that come along with me. He's not interested in any of that. Yeah. He's only interested in one thing, and that's his bride.
Yeah, this would have been such a different story if Ruth had been just a widow from Bethlehem, right? Israelite widow from Bethlehem. And it still would have been a great story, but when you take into account where she's from, that she is a Gentile, she is an outsider, and then you look at this whole story in the context of the rest of the story of salvation, it's so much more colorful, so much more beautiful, so much more comforting for us who, you know, we're outsiders, right? We are brought into the fold by our Redeemer. All right, well, we better finish this out.
Yeah, looks like we're gonna wrap up the book of Ruth today, man.
Yeah, verse 13. So Boaz took Ruth, and she became his wife, and he went into her. So they had intercourse, and the Lord enabled her to conceive, or literally, he gave her conception, and she gave birth to a son. So this is this pattern that we see, you know, originating in Genesis, where God is taking women who can't conceive for quite a period of time, and then he's blessing them with a child. So she continues this patriarchal story in herself.
Yeah, it is interesting that she didn't have a son before this. I mean, because she was married,
right?
And so it doesn't ever say that she was barren or anything like that. But at the very least, she had not conceived up to this point. And that seems to be intentional as well.
Yeah, and it the language it's used here does imply that the Lord had, well, to use the language of the Old Testament, had closed her womb, as it were.
Mm-hmm.
You know, she was not able to have any children until the time was right, and so she gives birth to a son. And interestingly, verse 14, it doesn't say, "And the women said to Ruth," but the women said to Naomi, "Blessed is the Lord who has not left you without a redeemer today, and may his name become famous or renowned in Israel. May he also be to you a restorer of life and a sustainer of your old age. For your daughter-in-law, who loves you and is better to you than seven sons, has given birth to him."
Now that's a hell of a statement for that time.
Oh, yeah. About the better to you than seven sons?
Yeah.
Oh, my. Yeah, I don't think that really strikes us the way that it should. But of course, you know, sons were preferred, and the seven sons, that's like, Ruth is better to you than the perfect children.
Right. Yeah. Seven
perfect
sons.
Number of children. Seven sons. Yeah. It's just like ideal.
Yeah, Ruth is better than essentially they're saying that Ruth is better to you than the perfect son.
Yeah. Yeah. Right.
You can do no better than Ruth.
Yeah. You can do no better than Ruth. Yeah. So it's just it's a wonderful way, a wonderful blessing that they give to her. You know, the Lord has not left you without a redeemer today. I mean, that could, we should turn that into a hymn of the church. That's still the message that gives us hope today. The Lord has not left us without a redeemer. So what does Naomi do? Well, Naomi, she kind of becomes the central character at the end. I mean, this is the book is entitled Ruth, and Ruth, of course, has been part of the whole story. But in the end, Naomi is the one who becomes the focus of attention. So Naomi took the child and laid him in her lap and became his nurse. I'm assuming at this age, it doesn't mean his wet nurse, so she's just taking care of him, right? So she more or less is receiving this child as her very own.
Well, you know, Boaz is a guy with some means. Probably what happened is, you know, Ruth has moved in and they have a baby and they say, hey, who would be a good person to bring on into the big house and have take care of the baby? Oh, we'll just have Naomi do that. So yeah. Things are working out good.
Yeah, they are. They are. And then we finish out these last few verses. So only time in scripture where this happens, where a child is named by the neighbors. The neighbor women gave him a name. A son has been born to Naomi, so they named him Obed.
And this is quite a statement too. A son has been born to Naomi, which it was born to Ruth. But this is such a Naomi has suffered such loss that this sort of new life being brought into the world, they are connecting this with her, right? That this is a gift of life to her.
Yeah, I mean, it's like a resurrection.
Yeah,
to her. I mean, she lost her two sons, she lost her husband, she lost everything, and now this child is a symbol of hope for her. So it's given to her as her very own. A son has been born to Naomi, so they named him Obed. And then in these last five verses, we get to, I wouldn't say it's the whole point of the book, but it certainly is the climax, because we learn why this story was so significant. Because Obed just happens to be the father of Jesse, the father of David. And then we wrap up with this genealogy. Now, these are the generations of Perez. To Perez was born Hezron, and to Hezron was born Ram, and to Ram, Amminadab, and to Amminadab was born Nahshon, and to Nahshon, Salmon, and to Salmon was born Boaz, and to Boaz, Obed, and to Obed was born Jesse, and to Jesse, David. So we've seen this in Genesis, that often in genealogies, the seventh person listed is the most significant, is like the focus of the genealogy. And the seventh in this particular genealogy is Obed. He's the focus of attention here, because he is the one who is now the promised child, who becomes, of course, the grandfather of David, which leads us to like the whole rest of the story of salvation, right?
Yeah.
That's why Ruth is so significant, because this leads to the line of David, the promise of David, the seed of David, from which, of course, eventually comes Christ our Lord. So,
definitely what you see is that you have all of this hopelessness, bitterness, this Moabite woman, all of this, of course, in the line of Christ, right? And this is what it is. And you have you see here, I mean, there's no way to not see the absolute providence of God working all the way through it.
Yeah. Yeah. Yeah, I mean, the whole narrative becomes kind of a narrative of resurrection, right? Where you feel like, Naomi, you know, there's I have no hope left. You know, everything I've lost, everything. I went out full, I came back empty. I went out lovely, I came back bitter. There's no more life for me. And then you read the rest of the story. So she's like at her Good Friday moment, right? And you read the rest of the story, and you realize, Easter's coming, right? The resurrection is coming, and that resurrection comes in the form of quite appropriately in the form of a baby that will be in the line of the Messiah. So just one of my favorite stories in the scripture, because of all of these very, very Christ-centered themes that emerge from the narrative.
Yeah. It's also, you know, Ruth is a nice book in the midst of the Old Testament, where you have two characters in Ruth and Boaz. You're like, I'm not saying they're righteous, but man, I really can't find anything wrong with either one of these people. They normally are, you know, your heroes have all kinds of flaws, and no doubt Boaz and Ruth did too. But it's not, you don't have to look very hard usually, you know, as we look at Abraham, Isaac, Jacob, Moses. We're gonna get into, you know, Samuel, and then into the Kings. It's not going to take a microscope to figure out where the flaws are in these people. Boaz and Ruth, man, they seem pretty legit.
Yeah, Yeah. And I love the fact that they're, you know, they're not royalty. They're just kind of ordinary people.
Yep.
You know, but they're ordinary people who, you know, nobody would have thought looking at them and seeing what was happening with them that they would be so significant, so central to the great story. But that is the way God works. You know, he's working in secretive, hidden sorts of ways that we don't always realize while we're going through them. But he has his ways of working them out for the good.
That's it, man. And that is where we're going to have to end it. Right there. Right. That is the Book of Ruth. We went a little long, but you know, we had to finish it up. So
yeah, glad we did.
You got a little extra. Next week we will venture into First Samuel.
Yeah, it's going to be fun. I mean, we're starting First Samuel, then we get to Kings. We're into a king is in sight. It won't be long now.
Yeah, we got the name dropped. We've heard there was no king in the land, but we just had the first dropping of his name right there.
Yes.
So, all right, Chad. Well, we will see you next week.
All right, see you then.